Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If you ask any random person on the street about the attributes that best defines being an American, even in these politically polarized times, one common answer would be the American work ethic, as well as our motivation surrounding work. In fact, American businesses spend millions and millions of dollars to engage their employees at and in their work. And in fact, according to my guest today, Oklahoma State University American Studies and History Professor David Gray, companies have been doing this for over 100 years. He traces the history of motivational rhetoric that came into being in the early years of the 20th century and how those messages changed over time during wartime, prosperous times, depression, and more recently, as the employer-employee relationship completely changed through the quest for ever maximizing profits and global competition. His book, Work Better, Live Better, Motivation, Labor, and Management Ideology, views the history of strategies to improve employee motivations through the posters, films, and advertising designed by industrial psychologists and advertising specialists to maximize profits and production, minimize union interests at the expense of workers and their benefits. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. David Gray, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Rich.
Your book examines the rise of job-based motivation efforts, and you track it through the 20th century and how the messaging changed over the course of time. What interests you in this particular facet of American history?
Yeah, well, when I began the research, I was really interested in the post-World War II period, and in particular, one of the most enduring mythologies, really, of the post-war period, which was this claim that class distinctions were becoming irrelevant in America. And, you know, this was pushed by big business, management organizations and so forth. And at the center of this was this idea that, you know, class was even disappearing. And, you know, historians understand that that was, that claim owed much more to the imaginations of business leaders than to reality. But nonetheless, it became a really powerful story, really, for the post-war period. And I thought that it was worth looking at more. But one of the things that seemed to be missing a little bit from the historical record was how all of this was promoted and sold at the level of the workplace. You know, was kind of familiar with it in a general sense in advertising and public relations. But what about the workplace? And so I thought, well, let's look at that. And I began with propaganda. We know, of course, there was a massive propaganda push in World War II that kind of spilled over into the post-war period. But I kind of began there. But once I got into the research, you know, going through boxes at archives around the country, I discovered that there was an even longer story to be told. And it wasn't only about propaganda, it was about motivation. And it was ultimately a story that was, is now over a century long, beginning about 1900 and continues into the present.
It's interesting you picked that time where, you know, class distinctions are irrelevant. You did see sort of an explosion of the middle class.
Yes.
Certainly, but certainly class distinctions were evident in television, in movies, in everything. There was a vast divide between those, and yet they're selling that it was becoming irrelevant?
Absolutely, and, you know, as fully clear to workers themselves and to working class people, right? But, you know, on kind of the surface level, you know, they would have you believe at the time that, class was a thing of the past. And of course, all of this was about, you know, from the business leaders' perspectives, it was about undermining unions and really trying to expunge the language of class from national life. It was a very sort of ideological push.
Yeah. So from that beginning, you began looking at this whole idea of motivation and job-based motivation efforts that really begin when the industrial age begins, which makes sense because prior to the industrial age, most workers either worked for themselves or directly for a single employer that paid them for job done at the end of the day, if you will. So how and why did companies see a need for motivational efforts in the first place?
Right. Well, as you come into the early 20th century, right, we have the rise of the industrial system sort of in the late 19th century. And managers, you know, traditionally had used, you know, force and coercion to try to discipline workers and to try to, you know, sort of keep them in line. But as you come into the early 20th century, and particularly once you get into the tens, you have the rise of industrial psychology. Economists begin to talk about the importance of psychology. And over time, you know, managers begin to realize that workers' emotions are really the battleground. And it sort of shifts from disciplining workers' bodies on the production line and instead trying to appeal to their minds and to sort of influence them on the psychological level.
How much was it due to the fear of rise of labor unions, which in management eyes in the 19-teens was communism?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. This is the big fear. And, you know, when you look at management journals during the period, you know, they're very fearful because they don't know where this is going to go. Workers are agitating for industrial democracy, which is kind of an arrangement in which workers would have more and unions would have more control and responsibility for planning and production and things like that. And it seems once you sort of come into the 10s, 20s and 30s that it may be possible. And so, you know, from management's point of view, they're looking for different tools. They're beginning to realize that force and coercion, even though they continue to use them, are sort of not the way to go if you want to try to indoctrinate and influence workers, you know, in the workplace.
One of the things your book does is you use the propaganda of the era and that these posters that are such a big part of workplaces, even to this day, you know, that talk about motivation and doing a good job, being safe in your job if you're in a dangerous job, that sort of thing. And this motivation stuff goes all the way back to the 19-teens.
It does. It does. And, you know, I mean, it even has roots in the late 19th century. That's right. And, you know, the whole idea kind of comes through in a big way in the 1910s when economists begin to emphasize the idea that workers' instincts are malleable, you know, because traditionally, you know, from the Darwinian point of view, instincts were assumed to be inborn and you couldn't really change them. But with the rise of behavioral psychology, something opens up, you know, and these conversations begin about, you know, how do we sort of manipulate the working environment with things like posters, things like everything from, you know, entertainment and education. And then, of course, maybe weekend picnics or annual picnics and sporting events and education, all that stuff. And so, yes, the whole idea that workers' emotions can be manipulated becomes kind of a big deal and sort of leads to, yes, all of the posters and films and everything.
How did motivational efforts look? What did they look like, say, in the 19-teens or 1920s?
Well, in the teens, of course, you've got World War I. And so, as you say, you've got the rise of propaganda and public relations. And once you come into the 1920s, you have the rise of these companies, particularly in Chicago, which are selling these posters and other publicity all over the country. This is when you get the first wave, really, of the nationwide motivational business. And they send these salesmen all over the country knocking on factory doors, selling, you know, hundreds of posters to these big firms. And so by the 20s, it kind of gets solidified and it gets somewhat standardized so that, you know, if you're a worker working in a different company, you're beginning to be exposed to some the same kinds of propaganda. So in answer to your question, I guess it's sort of becoming standardized during that period. It's not settled. I mean, and there are still managers in the 30s and even, you know, just before World War II, who aren't particularly interested in all of this emotional communication because, of course, they're trained in these older values of, you know, being rational and so forth. But it begins to switch, certainly once you get into the 30s in particular.
Well, what are the messages they're sending to their employees?
Well, it's this kind of moralizing messages about, you know, be a good worker and maybe you can advance to management. You know, don't gossip and, you know, don't waste time. Don't lurk around the factory gates passing out union literature and things like that. You know, it's very when you look at the publicity, you know, the propaganda of the 20s, it's a very elitist kind of mode. And, you know, you sort of think, well, I wonder how this went over with workers. And I don't think it particularly went over with workers very well. You know, workers would sort of reject it, basically. But nonetheless, it did sort of lay the basis for later efforts. And so when the later companies emerge in the 40s, you know, it's almost as if all of the formulas have been set and they can kind of update those messages in a more democratic lingo.
So in the 1920s, what I gathered was that there was this overall, this idea that if you work hard in your job on the factory floor, you know, whether it's sweeping a, you know, broom at mm-hmm. the very lowest end, or you're making the essential cog in the assembly line for whatever you're building, you can make it to become foreman, to eventually becoming an executive.
Right.
That seems to show up over and over again, this idea that if you just work hard, you will rise to the top.
Right. It's as if these messages are being written to the scripts of the 19th century bootstraps rhetoric, right? You know, the gospel of work. And in fact, a lot of the people that are designing this stuff in the 1920s have a background in salesmanship that goes back to, you know, some of them were born in the 1880s and 90s. And they kind of came up during that time. Yes, the whole idea of meritocracy and, you know, if you work hard enough, you can make it. And they're kind of bringing it to the factory. And in a way, they're sort of captivated so much by their own values that they don't really perceive that this isn't going to go over with the average, you know, working class worker. It's almost as if it's made for the small workshop of the late 19th century. And so in some ways, it's a failure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it does set them on the road to success.
But it's also about team building, too. You alluded to this earlier, that the fact that in this period, it was about, you know, not only are you doing the job while you're at work, we want to be involved in your life in other matters. How widespread was that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was, mailings to workers' homes. There were wage packet inserts. There were all kinds of sort of ways of trying to collapse the distinction and the space between work and home so that, you know, workers could be trained to see themselves as, members of a corporate family, you know, and there's an awful lot written about that. And so, you know, there was a big effort to do that. And in fact, some of the posters that you mentioned, you know, were kind of in some ways couched in a kind of domestic ideal, even down to the aesthetics of the borders of the posters. Some of them look like wallpaper, you know, kind of trying to make workers feel as if they're at home, you know, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. And of course, outside of the work hours, you're talking about baseball leagues, company teams. You're talking about picnics and bowling leagues later, you know, and all these sort of, I guess, strategies to break down barriers between management and labor.
Yeah, that's right. And, there's a lot written about that. I sort of touch on it and in the book. And this is sort of the era of welfare capitalism, right? And there's parts of that where you would say, well, I mean, it's maybe good that your employers are doing some of those things. But at the same time, of course, it's all ultimately sort of about, maintaining productivity and getting more out of workers for less. But importantly, sort of snuffing out workers' interest in labor unions. And of course, the 20s is a period where unions are thoroughly marginalized, you know, and it's not until the 30s that that begins to change.
My guest today is David Gray, a teaching assistant professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University and author of the book Work Better, Live Better, Motivation, Labor, and Management Ideology, which uses a lot of posters, but also a lot of deep research in how companies use motivation to break down the divisions between labor and management and how they use this propaganda to indoctrinate themselves in workers' lives and get messages across that they wanted to get them. Well, in the 1920s, it's about just work hard, strive, and you can succeed not only in your job today, but a better job tomorrow. Well, that begins to change in the 1930s when, you know, a lot of these large companies are seeing massive layoffs. How does the messaging change during the Depression?
Yeah, that's right. You get a real big shift in the early 30s. It sort of goes from this elitist mode to a more democratizing tone, I suppose. And of course, this is the period of the New Deal. FDR comes in and he himself is seen as a very kind of motivational figure. In fact, his own personal sort of struggle to, you know, overcome polio and so forth, it kind of, sort of underscores that. You know, what happens in the 30s is there is a real thorough rejection of the older elitist kind of mode on all kinds of levels beyond the workplace. We know it from popular culture and politics.
Well, we think, you know, the big thought is that the business capitalists are the ones that caused the Great Depression.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. And so, you know, these older messages that we talked about before are really not going to fly anymore. And you begin to see, you know, with the federal government, particularly like with the Farm Security Administration and the photograph unit that it sends around the country taking photographs of the Depression, you see that, you know, there's an emphasis on, I call it in the book, virtuous striving, you know, the idea that the nation is kind of affirming this ideal of virtuous striving. Photographs of hardworking Americans, you know, struggling against the Depression. And that kind of, you know, really sets the scene for something a little bit different. You know, of course you have the New Deal's support for labor unions. And so, you know, at the national level, you know, people are very sympathetic to labor unions. And in fact, the kind of laborist rhetoric sort of feeds into the culture on all levels. And so, you know, the motivational rhetoric takes a kind of democratic turn. It's still in the interests of, you know, big companies and things like that. But there's also a slice of it which is to do with a more communitarian kind of ethos, where if people come together, you know, the idea is that we can sort of get out of the Depression together. And that's kind of at the heart of the rhetoric of the 30s.
It's interesting you mentioned the Farm Security Administration and the, you know, the amazing photographers that are involved with that. The Farm Security Administration photographers like Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, Arthur Rothstein, and others who were documenting the effects of the Depression, a lot of times on farms, but also on small towns and the like. Mm-hmm. And then you also allude to other photographers that were photographing earlier, like Lewis Hine mm-hmm. in the 19-teens, mm-hmm. and, you know, showing the effects of industrialization. And usually it was not the positive effects. Right. So how did those photographs bring about a positive force towards motivation? Because when I look at them through history's lens, I look at them as saying, boy, times were really, really sucked.
Right. No, that's right. And, you know, one of the, of course, we need to recognize as well that, you know, the New Deal has different moments. There's the earlier period when the photographers are going out and they're being told by Roy Stryker, the unit's head, to get photographs that really show the struggles, yes, and the hardship and so forth. But once you come to about 1938-39, Stryker begins to tell the photographers, look, we want uplifting photographs. We want, you know, apple pie stuff. You know, we want, you know, resolute looking people, you know, standing outside of gas stations and things like that. So the photographs themselves sort of switch to a more positive intonation toward the late 30s. And that kind of lays the foundations, you know, for propagandists in World War II to sort of utilize them as well.
Yeah, that was one of the interesting stories, is how you would take these images. Oftentimes, if you saw the image in their black and white form, it would be an image of a desolation, of financial hardship, and they would be flipped around, cropped, colorized to make a more positive message in the 1940s.
Absolutely. And that was one of the sort of great moments when I was doing the research. You know, I had some posters out in the Smithsonian archives, and I had this great big poster. I include it right at the beginning of the book from the early World War II period. A bunch of guys stood outside a gas station, some of whom were wearing baseball uniforms. And, you know, it's kind of a tribute to meritocracy, and says, you know, this is America, something like, you know, where a guy can start at the bottom and there's always room at the top for the guy that works hard, this kind of thing. And I noticed at the bottom of the photograph in the poster, this colorized photo, the word Lang. And I realized, oh, it's a Dorothea Lang photo. So I got myself, you know, put my coat on and went over to the Library of Congress over on the other side of the mall and went into the files and found the original photograph. And then I kind of realized, oh, yes, they're using these photographs from the Depression in World War II photos. And as you say, they're colorizing them, they're cropping them and recaptioning them. So it's kind of this three C's, you know, for a different purpose. And it's so interesting to see how these photographs, which, as you say, are documents to hardship, sort of become something else, you know, with a little bit of image manipulation.
And there's a number of those photographs from that period, you know, with the idea, this is America, keep it free. Mm-hmm. And so when you went back and looked at the original Dorothea Lange photograph, is it telling a different story in its full entirety?
Yeah, they're just very factual captions. Lang wrote her own captions. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just quite factual. And so, yes, they're really changed in a number of ways. And it's interesting, you know, which photographs were chosen, because there are a great many which could be chosen. And the ones that were chosen, you know, they're very idealized, right? They're ones that are amenable to sort of visualizing this small town ethos. You know, there's one, I think, by Walker Evans of, you know, small town scene. You have farmers, you have this group of baseball players and other things. And so, yes, it just sort of shows you how those images from the 30s can, you know, really invoke different meanings if they're subject to some manipulation.
Of course, during the war period, the motivational techniques turned to we're all in this together. You know, the Rosie the Riveter, it takes all of us, whether you're planting a victory garden at home. And if you're working in the factory, you're working arm in arm with soldiers in the field. That was sort of the message that was pointed out to ensure that wartime production never flagged.
Absolutely. And, you know, you have these, I think I've got a photograph in the book of where you have members of the armed services, you know, coming for a factory visit and a factory tour. It's very much a genre piece, you know, it's sort of well known. But yes, collapsing that distinction between the factory, or that space really, between the factory and the theater of war was really very important. And the big thing that happens in the war is that the idea of prosperity becomes very big. And in fact, labor union leaders, as I was saying before, you know, they begin to sort of loosen their commitment to industrial democracy and instead to embrace this idea of, you know, economic prosperity. And that can be good for workers, but what is being lost in that change is, of course, you know, control over work.
Yeah. And of course, after the war, you have a whole crippling series of strikes, because you had the Depression for 10 years, then you had the war where you had price controls and wage controls, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden workers are saying, we want a part of this peacetime dividend we've been promised, and all of a sudden the motivation takes a very different spirit. It's a cooperative spirit. Hey, management and labor, we don't have to be at odds. We mm-hmm. just, by cooperating, everyone will profit. And that seemed, and that was what got you interested in this project to begin with, right?
Yes, that was the beginning. And in some ways, that's kind of the beginning of the culmination of the whole thing, you know, as you go sort of to 1945, 6, and then into the 50s. And that's right. You know, this whole idea that, you know, unions and managements could sort of be partners in prosperity. And of course, it didn't mean at all empowering unions. But what it really meant was that maybe we can kind of, you know, from management's point of view, kind of undermine class antagonism and sort of bring some of the unions along with this kind of model of business management, you know, and the idea that business is going to be the leader.
David Gray is my guest. He's a teaching assistant professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University. His book is titled Work Better, Live Better, Motivation, Labor, and Management Ideology, using posters going back to the 19-teens and his own research to look at how industrial organizations motivated their employees, the strategies they used, and how it changed over time. Well, certainly during the 50s, that was a time when, you know, all tide lifted all boats. You know, we saw incredible expansion mm-hmm. in the standard of living. But by the 1970s, that begins to change. And your last portion of the book talks about how companies motivate when there won't be the returns that they were promising, saying, in the 50s and 60s. So how does the motivation change then?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So, I mean, you know, after the war, as you say, you've had a good 15, maybe 20 years of prosperity. And at least, even though work becomes harder because of automation and because of all kinds of other things, you can at least say that, you know, the economic rewards were there. But yes, as we come into the late 60s and the early 70s, it begins to sort of wear off. We've got kind of the unraveling of the post-war economic boom. We've got the beginning of outsourcing, as we call it, and all of these other things. And of course, the big assault on labor unions, which really accelerates. And so, yeah, I mean, management begins to ask itself, well, how can we motivate workers if we can't offer them economic rewards anymore? And as we see today, it's sort of the same thing. We get this rhetoric about, you know, your work is your road to personal fulfillment. You know, your work is really your identity and things like that. We have this, you know, do what you love philosophy today, which we're all encouraged to do what we love. And, well, that can be okay as far as it goes, but of course it can wind up with, you know, a lot of young people doing unpaid internships and things of that nature. But the things, I think the big things to kind of come out of the late 60s and the 70s and 80s are things like work enrichment. That was kind of in the late 60s. And once you get into the 70s, management begins to adopt a kind of, the beginnings of what we call wellness today, you know, a kind of more new agey kind of approach. If we're not going to have economic rewards, well, we need to sort of bury that and sort of offer people something else, be it following your dreams through work, be it some kind of personal transformation and things like that. Mm. And all of which, you know, I make the argument in the book is rather illusory and misleading. In many ways, it can be good to sort of feel good about your work and so forth. After all, one of the problems throughout the history of work is that people have all too often had to work jobs which give them a very little reward and in which they feel exploited and so forth. But at the same time, it's clear that many of the promises today and sort of from the 70s onward are quite hollow because, you know, the work is not compensated as well as it used to be economically. And of course, workers have lost benefits and union protections because of the ongoing assaults on unions and things like that.
Yeah. It's interesting. Probably most people have seen at least some of the campaigns that you write about at the end of the book. One that caught my eye was the fish philosophy, mm-hmm. which is the Pike Place Market. And it shows this video, which shows the workers in the Pike Place Market at a fishmonger having a great time. And the idea is you make work what it is through your attitude. You know, I sat through that a few times. And and what's interesting is you had people at the Pike Place Market says, yeah, we had these guys with cameras, so we just started hamming it up for them, and right. They made a philosophy out of it.
Right. No, it really is interesting. And I think so many people today are familiar with these kinds of motivational seminars or, you know, when the employer brings in motivational speakers and things like that. And it's all presented as a little bit fun. But from the employer's perspective, you know, it's about collapsing the distinction between work and play, with the idea that they can make more productive workers and also that they can accommodate workers to changes that may be underway in terms of restructuring, which is always a pleasant euphemism for, well, some people are going to lose their jobs, lose hours or whatever it is. So on the one hand, you know, it's kind of this idea of play. And on the other hand, you know, there's always sort of another set of goals there that we don't necessarily see.
The name of the book is Work Better, Live Better. David, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rich. This is great.
David Gray is a teaching assistant professor of American Studies and History at Oklahoma State University and the author of Work Better, Live Better, Motivation, Labor, and Management Ideology. It's published by the University of Massachusetts Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.